This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 40 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And only for the month of January, earn up to $550 extra when you sell with The RealReal. That's right, up to $550 extra. Go to TheRealReal.com to get started. Earn up to $550 extra this month at TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
Okay, all right, it says it's recording now. So I have Annie here with me. Annie, I haven't seen you since 2019, I think.
I think that sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, it's been a crazy time. We were looking, if you remember, we were looking forward to the Armenian Games, the sort of pan-European Games in April last year, and I think we'd have all met then. Were you part of any of the committees?
You know what? No, I wasn't. I did think about it, but then kind of realized that, you know, it was very much kind of nicely handled as it was. So it was more on the, I can help on the day or when it actually happens, you know, just been running around and whatnot rather than on the organizing as such.
Mm. Yeah. Do you remember back then, when this sort of this unknown virus started to emerge, and then it was like this might have an effect on the games, guys. You know, do you have like a plan B? And the response was always, nah, this has got nothing to do with us. This is just, you know, it's nothing. It will pass, and so on. And then it was really very gradual, like when the realization set in that, you know, actually, this isn't just some, you know, a little sort of flu for the season or seasonal flu. This is something a lot more. Do you remember that when it started to sort of change, our sort of perception of it started to change?
I do vividly, but more than anything, I remember having this conversation about the Italian lockdown.
Okay.
And because obviously they start, I think they were the first in Europe to kind of go into lockdown, and their lockdown was very, very strict. Just like Spain, I think, like not allowed to leave their house for a walk or anything unless you're going to the shops. And we're like, is this a bit much? Like, are they taking that a little bit too far? There was that whole kind of conversation of not mockery, but, you know, almost like, not sure this is, you know, it's that important. And then slowly but surely, then started hitting here, like, oh, okay, hold on. Maybe it isn't just the flu. Maybe it does need to happen. But at the time, like, I don't think we ever saw it as something that would, you know, would still be going on now. We're like, okay, you know, we're just going to stay in our houses for, like, you know, 6 weeks, couple of months, and then, you know, we'll be fine. And then obviously it hasn't. It's really weird. Yeah.
Yeah. It's also almost like a classic case of, yeah, this will never happen to us, and so on and so forth, you know, because at, you know, the first we heard of it was people in China were dying. And even when it was in Italy, the first people to die were of Chinese origin.
Yeah.
And also, I think there was one death in France, and even that death was of Chinese origin. So then the conspiracy theories start to come in. Okay, one minute. Yeah. Have they created some kind of like DNA connected virus which only attacks Chinese people? You know?
I know. It's you know what? I was weirdly actually watching that trilogy of the prequels of Planet of the Apes. And it's actually quite weird because obviously there is a human made virus going on there that kind of like spreads across the world, and that's how, you know, the whole like Planet of the Apes kind of side of things ends up happening, with obviously not from an origin point of view of like human made versus, you know, come from animals. But it was quite weird to see you know, the kind of the parallels, if you like, on that point of view, and how far it could potentially go if it was like truly kind of out of control. Obviously, we're talking a movie, but you know, it's one of those where it kind of gives you a bit of a this could actually, you know, if not kind of controlled, it could go to a kind of very dangerous extreme.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And as you bring that up, it reminds me of another of a book that I read recently. I'm completely unaware. I thought I was actually going to be reading a thriller, but it turned out to be like one of these sort of natural disaster style movies, books. It's called Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. And it's about how a flu essentially takes over the whole planet, and then there's hardly anybody left. So there were no more nurses, there were no more engineers to fix things, there's no more internet, no more electricity, no more government, nothing. So basically, you know, at varying stages within sort of like a 12 to 15 month period, society gradually just collapses. Because they just simply were not in a position to deal with the pandemic. And I mean, the thing is, this story was written in 2014, so it had nothing to do with, you know, what is happening now. But I imagine the author, she's probably looking at that with a bit of fear in her. Yeah. No, oops.
But also that brings up a different question, which I think is like really interesting, which is, okay, we've got the society as we know it collapses. So that kind of opens up two avenues after that with like whoever is actually left. Do you then try to rebuild what was already there? Or do you actually go, hold on, we got this somehow. Maybe we did have, you know, something to do with the way things kind of progress. So do we take this as a like, kind of pause and the opportunity to build a new type of society rather than rebuilding what we already had? And yeah. Obviously, we're not anywhere near that kind of level of extreme, but I think that there's been lots of conversations and, you know, talks, etc., about, you know, pre-pandemic and post-pandemic in terms of what have we learned during the pandemic in terms of, you know, more of a community sense, more of a, you know, certain attitudes, if you like, that have taken place during the pandemic where we're like, actually, these are positives that have come out of this situation. Maybe what we need to do is try and make sure that we keep those moving forward and actually reinforce these kind of attitudes rather than trying to go back to the way it was before, in a way. So obviously, I think there's something really interesting in that in terms of like reevaluating, you know, what we know as, you know, a space of comfort versus kind of actually changing things and moving them forward into something that actually would make it better.
Do you see, for example, leadership playing a role in this? And I don't want to unnecessarily sort of introduce criticisms of government in any part of the world, but leadership as in from us, you know, we have the potential here to play a part, you know, and we could show our leadership capabilities in saying, okay, we will follow the medical instructions. You know, we will sort of make decisions for our communities, for our families, for ourselves, so that we can sit this out safely and then emerge from the other side. Do you think that sort of it speaks of the characters of our society?
You know what? I think it does, and I think it's one of those where whether depending on how much your government is doing and depending on how much you agree with what the policies are, etc. I think, you know, there is a role for kind of for society and, you know, us individually to kind of build networks or kind of support in a way that potentially isn't coming like top down. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at the end of the day, I think it's that sense of community I was talking about earlier. And I think, yes, there is definitely a role to kind of for us as individuals and as groups of people to kind of create these networks 100%.
And do you think also that we have as a society become somewhat dependent on governmental decision making, as in, you know, we are in many many ways in a position where we can actually react to these things, you know, without any kind of direction, and yet we fail to do so. You know, perhaps there's also an argument to say that, okay, we can of course blame governments, but on the other hand, we can also take responsibility ourselves.
I think, yeah, and I think the taking responsibility point is key. I think there is a degree of complacency and almost kind of like waiting to see what government is doing. I think, you know, it's kind of, I think you could see it a little bit with a lot of like U-turns, if you like, and like changes in decision that have been happening over the last few kind of weeks or months. And it's almost like we're sitting here kind of waiting to see what the decision is going to be. But, you know, we could and can kind of go, actually, I'm making the decision of thing. Actually, I think this is a dangerous situation right now. I'm not going to wait for the government to decide whether we're going on to lockdown or not. I'm, you know, going to take the step to kind of put myself into lockdown. I don't know. There was especially, I think we saw a lot of this like during Christmas. When there was a whole conversation of like, do we relax the rules slightly over Christmas? And you know, you could see the reaction when tier four was declared here. And then, you know, all of a sudden you had God knows how many kind of thousands of people just like leaving London. And again, you kind of think that was an immediate almost like reaction to a government decision. But, you know, I think it's something that people could have easily seen coming and kind of acted accordingly rather than, you know, just panicking. You know, I don't know. I think it was there is this degree of complacency of like waiting to see what the big boys are doing and are saying, as opposed to us actually taking the responsibility and making these decisions.
It's also quite interesting because I remember when this, you rightly brought up the example of Italy, and I remember when this sort of hit Italy, you know, in the north, sort of near Milan, in this, I think especially in this is a Bergamo area.
Yeah.
And then there were lots of, you know, these stories of people fleeing and, you know, moving out of Bergamo, going to, you know, wherever they had come from originally. And the government said, look, no, you can't do this. You're taking the virus with you. Do you think that's also, you know, potentially what has happened in the UK as well, that people have just sort of, you know, fled London, for example, and taken it with them?
Absolutely. And, you know, the idea of like people have fled London is really, really visible, like from so many people I know who have either kind of gone back to their parents or made the conscious decision to leave London. It's something you can see, like even in the housing market. Like I was house hunting like a few months ago, and the amount of property that's available for rent in London is insane. Like in an area where normally there isn't that much, you can literally just pick and choose what you want. It's not something you see. And yeah, like even from the workplace, so many are like, one's in Scotland, the other one went back to South Africa and's working from there. You know, so many, obviously there's still some in London, but like a lot of people have made the decision to just go away during all of this.
And have rental prices been negatively affected by this, or is it supply and demand and so on?
I think some have gone down, but there's a like strange situation. Like for example, in my own house, I'm in a house share, and one of the housemates moved out in December, which is a pretty bad time to move anyway. But obviously during the pandemic, it's even harder, and it's impossible to find someone. So, you know, we had like two responses to the ad in a month, when normally you get like 10 a day. So you can definitely tip. Obviously, our concern was like, well, we can't afford to pay this other person's rent if, you know, we can't find anyone. So I think the teller as to what the situation is was that the estate agent has actually agreed to cover that rent, if you like, so reduce our rent so that we only pay for, you know, us who are in the house, because they know that if we decide to move out, they will then have to, you know, put a four bedroom house in the market, and there's no chance they're going to be able to fill that in. So they've decided to kind of keep three people and take the hit of that one fourth, if you like, of the rent. and keep us going. So this in normal situations would never happen. The first thing they would say, well, it's not a problem if you can't find someone, so you have to, you know, pay for the full thing. So that in itself is a big teller. I think lots of landlords are reducing rents, and knowing that obviously a lot of people have lost their jobs or, you know, struggling, etc. So I think there is, you can definitely tell in a housing kind of market that there is, especially in the rent, on the rental side of things, that it's like a bit of a, you know, shift in that sense, and a bit of, right, we need to kind of write this out, because otherwise, like, you know, there's literally not going to be many people left in London who can afford renting.
Well, I mean, that was almost the case before the pandemic hit, but I obviously, you know, since people have, so many people have lost their jobs and so on, it's obviously, it's a big issue. So, all right. Okay, I was first introduced to you, Anya, I think it's about 5, maybe 6 years ago now, as Ani Barcelona, because obviously, our sort of mutual friends are, you know, very creative in coming up with names, right. Because you're Ani, and I presume you're from Barcelona, so therefore put the two together, and therefore we have a very original name for you. But yeah, could you tell me a bit about your background?
Yeah, sure. Oh my God, I can't believe the Ani Barcelona is always coming up.
Sorry.
Fine. I was born in Barcelona, as the name suggests. But yeah, my parents moved there from Istanbul via Germany in about, I think it was 1967. So obviously they're Armenian. So both me and my brother moved there, and it was a very strange choice, I would say, to move to Barcelona. I think obviously, like many people, they moved to Germany at the time, and I think my dad was offered the opportunity at the time to then either move to Canada or Barcelona. And I think part of their decision was being somewhere where there is an Armenian community versus not, but also it was the proximity to family. Obviously Canada is a lot further away from Istanbul, where kind of my grandparents were still based, and you know, from a climate point of view, being near the sea and all that kind of side of things, Barcelona was like really attractive to them. So that's what they did. And so I grew up there, went to a French school there.
A French school in Barcelona?
Yeah, so I did almost everything from like preschool through to the equivalent of A levels in French, so basically like the French system, but based in Barcelona. I think that was partly, I think both my parents did their kind of secondary school in French. But also it's a very good school. And, you know, they believed in the system. And for me, like my dad always had like a very strong opinion about the importance of languages and kind of learning as, you know, almost like as many as possible, as young as possible, because, you know, it's a huge door opener, which I do kind of agree with. Like he started teaching me English when I was 7. We used to do like lessons at home, which obviously I used to hate as a kid. I was like, I want to be playing. But you know, that means I started English about 4 years before I did at school, so you know, I always was you know, a little more advanced level, so that was always like, you know, really helpful, and it has proved really helpful in the future. I went to French school there, then I did business school in Barcelona, which was a bit of a random choice. So I was one of those kids who liked anything from philosophy to chemistry and enjoyed all of it. Didn't really know what I wanted to do at the time. So I kind of went for the more practical choice, if you like, and said, you know, that having that understanding of business in a way will probably, you know, be a practical thing that will come in handy for the down the line, but still not really knowing what I wanted to do. Allowed me to do my exchange in Sydney, so I spent like 6 months in Sydney as part of my master's there, which was really great, and kind of in fairness was an indicative of me having itchy feet and wanted to kind of go away from Barcelona and almost like, you know, explore almost like have my own kind of little world and kind of build that on, you know, just for myself. Went back to Barcelona and started working more in more corporate world side of things, but soon enough realized that that wasn't really for me. And a friend of mine kind of pointed me in the direction of a design, a brand design agency, saying maybe that's something where, you know, they're looking for someone, you've got the kind of marketing kind of knowledge and all that kind of side of things, but you've got the creativity as well, could be interesting. And that's, yeah, I was kind of back in what, 2003? So, and that's, yeah, I've been working in that kind of brand design, packaging, some events kind of side of things ever since, really. And then, yeah, I think Itchy Feet kind of didn't stop from there. And eventually I decided to move to London. Actually, 15 years to the day today.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's weird. If we say 15, I was like, wow, that's, you know, it's a long time.
It is a long time. It's a very long time. Okay, so so you've also shown yourself to be a very independent woman. So, you know, as you said before, you made your own choices, as it were, with regards to so your education. You know, you applied a practical approach to, you know, the subject that you would study, but also deciding to go to, you know, a country like Australia. So it's very far away. And you know, I guess you wanted a challenge, right? You wanted to sort of cut loose and go somewhere completely different.
Yeah, in fairness, it was a combination of things. Like, I remember the time we had, you can go to these American kind of universities or da da da. And I was like, well, I think it's quite easy to end up going to America on a trip kind of thing. Whereas, like, for me, Australia was like, actually, it's not on your way, if you know what I mean. It's literally on the other side of the world. I also had like someone I know who was living there at the time, and I've always had, like, my dad when I was a kid had gone there for work, and you know, I always had this idea of like, I actually really want to spend time there. When am I going to have the opportunity to spend like 5-6 months down there, in a way? And also, I mean, at the time it was like as far away from my parents as it could be, so no disrespect to them, but you know, as a 20-21 year old, I was kind of, you know, really wanting to have my space, my independence, and you know, just kind of figure things out on my own. So yeah, it was one of the best experiences I've ever had, and you know, just being there with lots of exchange students from all over the world, you know, seeing a completely different country. We did like a 1 month road trip around the country, from, you know, desert to jungle to cities. It was amazing, and you know, it's, I think I learned so much from it, you know, just from living and, you know, having that 5-6 months period of trying to see, find out who I am, but also kind of getting all this new stimulus and, you know, satisfying that curiosity that was bursting out, really.
Okay. And also how you are, what kind of a person you are, but also how you fit into a group of others, as it were. I guess that's also quite educational for somebody.
No, absolutely. Especially because what I was studying was a weird program, which was like a BA and an MBA, which normally you only do once you've already kind of worked. So the people in my class were all people who were 6, 7, 8 years older than me. So people who had been in the professional world and worked and done all of that and then gone back to do a master's. So again, it was, you know, I was quite different from that group, literally kind of being still in uni. But, you know, no one really cared at that point. And, you know, you just like one more person kind of thing coming from whatever your background is. And I don't know, it was, I learned a lot from them because obviously they've had different, completely different experiences to mine. And yeah, I think, yeah, it was both really eye-opening in terms of just getting, in contrast to Barcelona, where at least at the time was somewhere that was very kind of, what's the word? Samey. You know, Barcelona is very Catalan and all Spanish, if you like. There's from a diversity point of view, it's a lot. It's changed a lot now, but back in the day, you know, it was very kind of local in a way. So it's not somewhere where you get, you know, lots of different people from lots of different places. Whereas, you know, Sydney in that sense, and especially in an exchange program, then you do get all of that. And again, like you do in London, that's, you know, partly one of the reasons why I moved here was, you know, first day of like stepping here, it's like, whoa, you know, you such like level of diversity just walking around in the street that you don't, you know, you don't see in Barcelona.
And just on a side note, when you were in Australia, did you see many Germans?
No, why?
Because I tell you, almost every second or third German I meet, they're like, yeah, I went to Australia, and then they start talking to me in English, and you know, bit by bit, the Australian accent creeps in. And I was in an Irish pub once in Berlin, and this guy eventually he got that Australian bit took over him so much, he called out to the waitress, "Hey, Sheila," and I was like, "Oh my God," I was so embarrassed, and this. Poor woman came over, she said, "Oh, my mum's name is Sheila," and it just went downhill from that point on. But okay, this didn't happen, and you didn't see too many Australian accented Germans.
I don't think I met any Germans when I was there, if I'm completely honest.
Okay.
So, no, that's a good story though.
It's crazy, but there you go. Okay, all right, cool. So your first impressions then of London were extremely positive. I guess the fact that you've stayed in London for 15 years would suggest that the positives have by far outweighed the negatives.
So far, yes. And you know, I think, as you were saying, I think, and as an example of like what I meant by the diversity side of things, I was, when I first came to London, which was before I moved here, so back, I think it was 1999, I think it was. So me and a friend of mine, she's half Scottish, half Armenian, but she doesn't speak Armenian. Mm-hmm. But we were on a night bus coming back from God knows where, like 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And we're chatting, and I did say something to her in Armenian, I can't remember why, that this guy who was sat in front of us turns around, says, "Are you too Armenian?" "Yes." Well, he's like, "I'm Iraqi, but my sister is married to an Armenian." And then he proceeds to start singing Armenian songs to us.
Oh, God.
And I'm like, my brain is exploding at that point. I'm like, what just happened? So it's things like this that, or again, in the same week, we go to this pub, there's four guys standing outside having a chat. We start talking to them. Turns out, they're mates, right? So one of them is Turkish, the other one is Turkish Cypriot, one's Greek, and the other one's Greek Cypriot. So just for a minute, imagine this, especially with everything that's been happening recently, at a macro kind of, you know, geographic political level. You've got these four guys and us who join in and spend an evening just chatting, random whatever evening, having a drink. And for me, again, that blew my mind in terms of, you know, that animosity that you see, at, you know, obviously culturally and politically between us as nations. But there, as six people who are just having a nice evening and having a conversation, it's that contrast in a way, again, I don't know, is something that I'm really, you know, really interested in, and kind of how you can go through these boundaries that, you know, and forget all of the noise in a way, and just like focus on the people you have in front of you. And those are two of my very first London experiences that kind of really kind of attracted me in terms of, and made me want to come here and kind of be part of that in a way, I guess.
I mean, London obviously provides the opportunity, doesn't it, because of its sheer size, the fact that it's got such a sort of, you know, dynamic labor market. You know, there's always something for people to do if indeed they choose to do so. But a lot of it actually comes down to individual decision making, doesn't it? As in, when you go somewhere, it's almost as though you have an opportunity to completely redefine yourself. And will you become a positive sort of integrated member of the community? Do you want to actively pursue friendships with diverse groups, or are you going to be a bit more inward looking and sort of just go about your yeah. life, work and so on? So, you know, a bit like what we were saying before, you know, a lot of it is up to the individual, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I agree 100%. And I think on that front, it's just made me think of something like when I first moved here, you know, I could have very easily kind of gone to and, you know, find where the Spanish people are and hang out with the Spanish people, which weirdly, I never did. I don't think I have a single Spanish friend in London. My initial, I mean, I was lucky enough to find a job like really quickly, like within a month of being here, and like very quickly was integrated in a very English environment. Like for years, 99% of my friends would be, you know, English, and I got to, in a way it was like a fast track lesson in into Britain and like cultural elements and all that kind of side of things. I've, you know, many of my friends kind of say, you're almost like more English than us sometimes. And it's really like, you know, much later that I then started kind of hanging out with Armenians as well. Like I think I did reach out to, I did have a good like Armenian friend here, but he was the only one I would hang out with. I did go to a few kind of parties, but it just didn't click for me, you know, where it was like there's something I'm not feeling this. And again, having not grown up in a community, in Armenian community, there were a few things that I found a bit strange, or I don't know, it didn't work for me. So it was like I left that and didn't really get involved until maybe what, 5 years ago, I think,
which is more or less around the time that we met. It is interesting that, isn't it, because knowing the group, at least a part of the group that you know, interact with and yep. you are friends with, you know, I would say, even though they are, you know, Armenian in ethnic origin, but they are very, very European yeah. in the way that they, you know, they live their lives as a British, but also sort of Europeans. And I think that maybe makes them a bit more welcoming to newcomers, don't you think?
I think so. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I have spent time with Armenians. So I did used to go to Istanbul a lot as a teenager. Like there's this, you may know about it, this place called Kanalada, which is this.
I don't know, I'm sorry.
So there is this kind of group of islands in Istanbul, like between the two parts of Istanbul, called the Prince Islands. Okay. Where a lot of basically people spend their summers there. And one of them, which is this island called Kanalada, is the one that traditionally local Armenians spend their, basically local Armenians spend their summers there. So that's where my parents met, for example. And my dad had kept the kind of family flat. And then when I was, I think when I was about 14, we then started going there for summer and spending like maybe 3 weeks a month there. So again, that was amazing as an experience, because I then got to see lots of Armenians like me. So being like second generation elsewhere, but that'd be like Armenians from LA, from Germany, from Canada, from actually not from the UK, maybe not so much, because there's not that many Istanbul Armenians here. But basically imagine like lots of people like me with a similar background, but having grown up in anywhere in the world, congregating in a tiny little island for summer. So, you know, but I think that was my kind of understanding of Armenian kind of community in a way, but I got that like 3 weeks a year kind of. So I guess in a way that's why when I moved here, I then kind of, I was looking for it in a way. But yeah, it's, I think I'm more drawn to those that have a bit more of a like a positive kind of attitude towards other cultures, or, you know, that integrated element, than certain potentially more closed off and potentially more opinionated, in my view, kind of community. But I think that's partly because of my own background, you know, saying like growing up as an Armenian in Barcelona and then having moved here and then having spent time, you know, in a French environment for like, you know, 15 years at school, and then Australia, I do tend to kind of, I like that diversity. I like that kind of the fact that you can take from all these different cultures the things that are, that work for you in a way, and make them become like a part of you. Mm. And, you know, there's loads of things that I do that I say that can be very Spanish, but then there'll be certain things that be like, oh, that's very English. Or, you know, it's just almost like creating a kind of identity in a way that kind of leans on all of these different inputs. I think there's something, you know, that's how you become richer in a way. Mm. You know, I do like that kind of attitude, that mentality of like people being, you know, open to that.
And talking of identity, as in, you know, a couple of times when we've discussed football, you know, you're very you're very much a Barcelona fan, aren't you?
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right. It's not going too well for you this season, though, is it?
Well, it's a transition season. I keep saying this, you know. That's what you said. I mean, we did have the most terrible last year was kind of almost embarrassing. You know what game I'm referring to. I'm not going.
I may remember. But the last few seasons there have been a number of embarrassing games. But anyway, yes, please.
Yeah. Nah, there is. That, you know, I'm almost like kind of I do challenge my dad on that one quite a lot. It just makes me laugh. But yeah, no, there is. It's a transition period. We've got like a few older players. We've not been like particularly good with our coach selection recently. Mm. You know, it's team rebuild time, let's face it. So I'm not expecting, you know, major wins this year. So as long as we don't have major losses like we did last year, I'll consider myself lucky.
Okay, but to tie in a bit, there's sort of two elements then, because you also said you work in sort of branding and marketing and so yeah. on. I would suggest that in recent years Barcelona's PR has not been quite up to scratch. What do you think about that?
In what way?
Well, for example, the debacle with Messi over the summer, it was sort of long drawn out. Also, the, you know, the presidents, the tag team of presidents, you know, one comes in and the other one goes out, and then the one that went out starts, you know, bad mouthing, and it comes back in a couple of years later. It just sort of goes around in roundabouts. And I do remember a few years ago, you know, in the UK, we were talking so positively about the system, because Barcelona is owned by the fans. Is that not essentially the case?
Yeah.
And yet still the management is not ideal.
Mm. No, you're right. And I think there's been part of the reason as well is there, from what I understand, and I'm probably not close enough to it, there's a fair bit of animosity between some players and the, you know, the team management as such. And that's something that's definitely affected, you know, from a PR point of view, and, you know, all this kind of skirmishes kind of actually coming out to light and kind of being on the press. Whereas like potentially in previous years when, you know, everything was working nicely, and, you know, it was like one happy family, if you like, then obviously I think the PR itself had a positive impact, because actually things were fine and dandy, if you like, within team and management. Whereas it's something that in the last maybe like 2-3 years has definitely not happened. Like, you know, Xavi, for example, has been like quite open about how he feels about the current management. Messi kind of doesn't really talk about it, because, you know, he knows it's not his role. But yeah, I don't know. I think there's elections due to happen in the next month or so. So there's a bit of a hope that things will change and kind of, you know, start going back to, you know, that really kind of strong team kind of element that Barcelona is known for.
Yeah, but isn't it a bit funny in some ways that this the sort of internal political issue has arisen as the team's abilities on the pitch have dwindled. So I'm talking, you know, players like Iniesta, Xavi leaving, and obviously Messi is, you know, he's getting older. He can't carry the team as much as he could have done perhaps in the past. You know, I mean, I would say Xavi and Iniesta, along with Paul Scholes, being a Manchester United fan, you know, three of the best midfielders who have graced football in the last 20, 30 years. As in, but to lose two...
Yeah. And again, like, you know, it's losing them was both from... not just from a quality of play side of things, but also from a... Like, they were, like, so ingrained in the kind of the Barcelona fabric in a way. It's like from the fans as well. They are, you know, they are beyond adored as players. Kind of them leaving as well. And obviously it has an impact on that also on the play. And you can tell that. You can definitely tell that, you know, the way the team is working now is kind of, you know, miles from where it was before. And you know, it's when you start getting cracks in the results that, you know, obviously other issues that potentially before weren't talked about so much or weren't as relevant, they start coming out as well. I think, you know, when things go well, who cares, things are going well. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, you know, we're winning everything, etc., everyone's happy. There's certain like political issues or whatever that, you know, you don't pay so much attention to. But when things start not going so well, then everything all of a sudden just like starts, you know, bursting out and making their way out to the public. So I think, you know, I don't think that happens just in football. I think it happens in, you know, everything. The second things start kind of going a bit not so well, then problems kind of rise to the surface, really.
Yeah, I guess in football, because it's so high profile, then sometimes the problems are far more exaggerated, perhaps is the best way to put it.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, but I mean, one of the issues I wanted to really talk about as well, and this is why I introduced the Barcelona factor, is that you've obviously are from Barcelona, as in you are essentially Catalonian, and... you're very proud, I think, of your roots and your attachment to the area. How do you see some of the political issues regarding potential autonomy, shall we say? How do you view that? And now from a distance as well.
Actually, the from a distance point is key, I think. Well, yes, you're right. I've always felt like really proud of the Catalonian side of things. And I will always say I'm Catalonian rather than being Spanish. But I think for me, that's more from a cultural point of view. And I think, you know, there are some clear differences. There's a lot in common, but there's also a lot of like differences between like, you know, Catalans and Spaniards. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the current issues have come from very poorly managed political situations back in maybe like a decade ago, where I think the Catalan government was asking for a bit more autonomy, a bit more independence in terms of like managing the taxes or, you know, in terms of
education.
Yeah, as you know, like Spain is like it's not like a centralized country. It does have all kind of different autonomies, and different autonomies have different degrees of autonomy. Like the Basque country, for example, they have a very different set of laws where they are a lot more independent from like a central government that maybe other autonomies are. And Catalan sit like somewhere in the middle. And there was this ask for there's this bill that was being written to kind of establish a bit more of that kind of independence. And all of that was kind of in the process of being signed off, and eventually it didn't. And I think that's one of the, that was a trigger. Mm-hmm. Like, there's always been a sense of, you know, an independent kind of movement in Catalonia, but it was always like relatively minimal. Like, I honestly never thought I would see what's happened in the last 10 years Like it was always maybe, I don't know, say like 20% of people who were like, yeah, you know. But getting to a point where there's like all the kind of demonstrations on the street, there's all the kind of the elections and all that kind of side of things for independence, I honestly never saw I would see that. It's not something you could have sensed before that kind of turning point, if you like. And then from then on, I think, you know, the political, like local political parties took that, even parties that weren't traditionally for independence, took on that mantle. I think it was partly a political game in terms of, right, there is huge frustration coming from the people about this kind of bill not passing. Let's capitalize on that. And there's been a lot of that over the kind of the last few years, I think. Madrid have not been smart about it, I don't think. Like for me, I've always compared the Scottish situation to the Catalan situation and how that was handled. Like, for example, how the referendum was handled. The Catalan referendum was not allowed. It was deemed illegal.
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, for me, it's like basic psychology. You know, you tell someone you can't do it, well, we're going to go for it. Whereas I think I'm not a David Cameron fan, but, you know, I think there's one thing he was really smart about was, OK, you want to have a referendum? Have it. And then, you know, you'll deal with the results after that. And whereas that wasn't allowed in Spain. And that's where all of the kind of current issues come from. It was that kind of Madrid versus Barcelona media taking it to, like, if you see like Madrid papers versus Catalan papers, it becomes like a huge media battle. There isn't like a really objective kind of take on any of it. It's all kind of, everything is fueling like that animosity.
Yeah, there's a definite lack in objectivity, I think, everywhere. Aardman has often commented, I'm sure you've probably talked about it with him as well, that in the USA, for example, you know, objective media reporting just doesn't exist. You're in one camp or the other, and you essentially get very polarized views. And so I can only imagine that in Spain, it's the same.
Yeah. And that's why I think like being not actually being there, and seeing this from, you know, from the UK, I've taken a much more objective view of it. Like I'm someone who's, I've always preached like for the difference between like Spanish and Catalan, the fact that there is something there. And yes, there are grounds for independence, but you know, I think that if you do it, you need to be smart about it. You know, for things like, for example, especially with Brexit in the back of my mind, if leaving Spain implies not being part of the EU, I'm not entirely sure that's the smartest way about, you know, to go about it. But whereas I think the conversation that's happening within the country itself is very, again, like the grey area doesn't exist. All the kind of the media portrayal and all of the conversations, all of the rallies that happen, it's all very black and white. And I find that really frustrating. And I see like my parents, for example, they're like super involved in that. Like my mum like listens to the radio constantly, and she makes a point of like listening to both sides, which I find quite interesting. You know, she listens to like very kind of the more kind of Spanish central or Spanish centric, if you like, point of views, and she'll listen to the very Catalan point of views. And she herself, like, probably because of being Armenian, both of them are very kind of pro-Catalan and pro-independence, actually. But yeah, at least that kind of, they make the point of like trying to get both of those opinions. But I don't think that's something that people do tend to do there. It's very single-minded and kind of, you know, you're either one of us or you're one of them. There's a lot of that happening in Barcelona.
Okay. I mean, yeah, these sort of binary situations have never really appealed. Well, maybe they appealed to me when I was younger, but I'd like to think I've grown up a bit and matured a bit and come to the conclusion that, you know, the world is not binary. in any way. And there are many, many degrees in between. And depending on the topic, you know, there are more or less degrees. But it's cool to see that your parents don't live in an echo chamber and they only sort of pursue news from the one side. I guess that also alludes to the open-mindedness that you have. So, I mean, it's not just where you grew up, but also, you know, who you grew up with.
Mm. No, absolutely. Definitely. I mean, yeah.
And I mean, in Barcelona, how is the discussion of sort of gender equality? As you know, I discussed this with Tatiana as well. And you know, perhaps you have a different cultural insight with regards to this. How was it in Barcelona growing up? Was it a case of the boys play football, the girls do knitting? Was you know, was it like no? Because recently on German television, there's some brilliant TV programs for children, and they had a little sort of survey of the kids, and they asked the boys, you know, are you better at maths than the girls? And the boys were like, yeah, we're great, blah blah blah. And then they asked the girls, and the girls were really quiet. They didn't say anything. They said, yeah, I think we're as good. And then the teacher got out like some sets of results and said, well, girls, actually, you're a bit better than good. Yeah, as in, you know, it's interesting that some of these issues still remain in schools. And so my question is, you know, growing up in Barcelona, did you have that kind of pressure as well?
To be honest, like, I'm just trying to think. I don't think there was so much of a we're better at this than you are or all of that. On the contrary, I actually think that girls were probably getting like better grades than boys were, but if anything, like, I would say that boys would potentially, you know, mock those that, you know, would be better at this or better at that. But no I don't think there was that sense of like, oh, you know, we are boys so we are better at this. I don't think there was that kind of division. Yes, in terms of like playing football, you know, games and sports and all that kind of side of things. I mean, yeah, like football and all those kind of things were still very much seen as more of a boys thing than a girls thing, I guess. But right. I don't know, like I never felt, or I don't remember having that kind of, oh, you're a girl, you shouldn't be doing this kind of thing. I don't remember having that kind of feeling or that ever being like a concern or an issue. But
sorry.
No, go on.
No, I was just going to ask because, you know, I'm sort of thinking back to the point when, you know, these political issues occurred in Barcelona a few years ago, and, you know, arrest warrants were issued around Europe for, you know, these Catalonian representatives, but none of them were women. A lot of the political leaders are men. And so do women get involved in, you know, sort of Catalonian politics?
More now. You're right. Like I'm not saying that there isn't sexism in Catalonia or in Spain, because if nothing else, like it's possibly one of the country's biggest downfalls. And is the way I see it is one of the countries where sexism is actually rife and actually quite strong and dangerous to a degree. But I think I was lucky enough to not really kind of see it in my environment or in my surroundings. But I think you're right, like from a leadership point of view, it has been traditionally very much male led. But there is a conscious effort, or there has been, I think, in the last few years, of having more female representatives. I think, like from a central government point of view as well. I think it was a couple of prime ministers ago. He started making a point of having like female ministers in the cabinet, and actually not a majority of them, but like quite a strong number, which was, you know, the first time that was ever happening. I think in Catalan politics, there's still very much male dominated. There are some female figures, but it's still very much on the male side for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, allowing cooler heads to prevail, I think is perhaps a part of the issue when it comes to these kinds of conflicts. I think about Germany and the massive the massively positive effect that Angela Merkel has had on many different crises. And this September she's stepping down after what will be 16 years as the Chancellor, and she's going to be replaced, and none of the main or front running candidates are a woman. And I think she tried to bring to have a woman take her place, but unfortunately proved unsuccessful in that field. And it seems that the next chancellor is going to be a man. So I think Germany and also Europe would love Mrs. Merkel to have continued for another 4 or 8 years, but unfortunately she doesn't want to do so that's fair enough.
I mean, after 16 years I'm guessing she's kind of thinking, time to think about myself now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, always she stayed on because the country was in a crisis. So in 2015 there was the refugee crisis, and so she said, okay, I'll stay on and see the country through it. Obviously now there are two crises, as it were, one for Europe, which is Brexit, and then for Germany, obviously, is dealing with the pandemic. Mm. I think her kind of leadership would have helped guide both Europe and Germany through these two crises.
I agree. And I think for me, I mean, I think she's a really inspirational kind of person and role model for women in that sense, because I think she's, and again, I don't know her politics that closely, but as a figurehead and, that kind of cool, calm, collected, very kind of, very much positioned as an equal, if you like, where she just doesn't take any kind of BS from, the kind of the sphere that she moves in, is something that I respect very much. And I think that potentially, if I comparing her to like Theresa May, for example, it's just, you just can't put the two in at the same level. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think there is a strength, there is a calmness, there is a rationality in a way that comes from, and she radiates that in a way. She's very kind of, she inspires respect immediately. Mm. And that's something that I very much admire from her.
But it's a quiet strength, though, isn't it, that Mrs. Yeah. Merkel has? As in, people try to also draw parallels between Mrs. Merkel and Mrs. Thatcher. But, Mrs. Thatcher was far more antagonistic, I seem to recall. She was well up for the fight, whereas Mrs. Merkel was more like, well, actually, let's not fight. Take a moment, think about it.
It's that diplomacy, right?
Yeah.
In a way, it's not about... I think she's made her mark by almost like observing and then, just observe, assess, and then take the right step, rather than kind of being overtly confrontational or antagonistic, as you said. Yes.
Mm. Yeah. And I mean, okay, she's obviously got a very, extensive academic background. She's extremely intelligent, and perhaps these analytical skills were helpful, especially in the scientific crisis that we've had. But it's also interesting that Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand was also considered to be one of the most successful leaders in dealing with the pandemic. So, maybe there's something in that.
I think I keep going back to that idea of community. I'm sorry, but I think it's more of the mindset is slightly different in that sense. Like how the approach, I think there's been... a lot of like politically led decisions that have been made here, potentially, where certain decisions around the pandemic have been made more as in like, how is this going to affect my position in parliament or with my kind of peers in that kind of side of things, instead of necessarily thinking about the people in the country in a way, whereas I think in New Zealand it's that's the other way around. I think she's been incredibly smart, and that's that's how she's gone about it. She's like, you know, again, it is a smaller country as well. It's probably like easier to manage and to kind of take on the kind of the steps that she did. But, you know, closing off the island and saying, you know, it's going to hurt for a couple of months, but we'll be much better for it in the long run. It's definitely kind of proved right. Whereas, you know, the fact that we've only kind of asking people to take a negative test when before they land in the UK, that only is happening now as we speak, again, blows my mind slightly.
Okay. All right, moving away from the pandemic, which, you know, I think understandably, it's, you know, I think every serious conversation at the moment involves some kind of reference to it. But talk about your work. So that may actually be in some ways affected again by the pandemic. But I seem to remember you work in a project for a certain period of time. And then when you've guided that project to a successful conclusion, you then move to another project. Is that still how your employment works?
Yes and no. So, yeah, I'm a freelancer. So I've been freelancing for the last four years, I think. So yes, it's not necessary. It's more kind of in terms of like filling gaps, if you like. So yes, I will be kind of brought in to drive a kind of a project or a series of projects for a period of time. Sometimes it's whether, you know, they don't have the permanent resource, if you like, to run that project. Sometimes it's from a skill set or experience point of view that, like, actually we need someone who knows a lot about this side of things and I have the right kind of background of skill set to do it. So yeah, it's more of a kind of dip in and out kind of approach at the moment. Yeah.
So what is that specific kind of skill set that you know, people sort of reach out to you for then?
It can be, well, partly kind of years of experience. Like I've been in doing this for about 16-17 years now. So sometimes it's more the fact that they don't have the level of seniority to cover a certain project. Sometimes it's more from an industry knowledge. So I've, for example, done a lot of work with the drinks, alcoholic drinks industry. So, you know, doing design work for, say, whiskey brands or beer brands, etc. And, you know, there's something I'm very familiar with. So, you know, they need someone who has that level of understanding. Or, for example, I've done a lot of, instead of focusing on one area, so brand design and packaging, I made a point earlier in my career to kind of open that up and then do some work on what we call like experiential or events, or, you know, basically almost have more of a 360 degree view as to how you kind of build a brand and you communicate it and sell it kind of target audience, rather than being very kind of focused onto one area. So some projects actually do need that kind of more bird's eye view, if you like, or understanding of the wider kind of touch points, if you like, rather than going super deep on one area.
Okay. And is that also, that's a very interesting topic, because I mean, recently, because lots of businesses have been obviously closed to the public, yeah, they've tried to introduce these sort of all-encompassing, engaging experiences, with virtual events or virtual platforms. Is this something that you've also managed to integrate in some ways?
Not so much on my side, in terms of, because I've not really been working recently on that kind of experience side of things. But it is most definitely something that now, in the types of projects that I've now started to work on, it is on the back of our minds always, in terms of, you need to, you know, it's not just about live experiences. It's not just, you know, it's adapting your brand strategy to what's happening, right? So if people are not going to venues anymore, and they're not kind of being put in front of your brand there, what do you do as a brand to actually take the brand to these people's homes? So from a strategic point of view, it's definitely an element that has been added into, you know, consideration. It's not, you know, how do you bring this home rather than being out, is become like an intrinsic part of that strategic process.
Okay, so it has sort of changed a bit. The project has changed in response to the realities in which you exist.
Yeah, but not even just at project level, but even at like very high up kind of brand strategy point of view, it's, you know, acknowledging the fact that people are barely leaving their homes right now. So how do you now reach these people? It's, you know, it's become, because otherwise it has impact on their bottom line at the end of the day. So it's how do you kind of reverse the situation and make sure that you build that into how you kind of approach your brand.
Okay. Yeah, it's really interesting how you know, different organizations with extremely different products, how can you convey a flavor, a taste, a tradition, when there is no sort of physical contact or presence around it? Obviously, this is where the creativity comes in. So it's really interesting to see how that happens.
But you can tell, like, things, for example, a lot of, like, again, drinks brands have been doing things like, you know, that people are not going to be going to a bar and drinking a cocktail, but they've, especially some of the smaller brands, have been really smart about it and said, well, we're going to start creating cocktail making kits and, you know, things that you can order online. They're being delivered to your home in, you know, in a box that fits your letterbox. So, you know, if you happen to be out, well, it doesn't matter. It's there. And, you know, just getting and then creating more of an experience, something they can do at home, and maybe will become supported by some online content or, you know, someone on Instagram telling you how to make that cocktail or giving you, you know, a couple of recipes or advice. So it's become, you know, there's, is that kind of partly educational, because you're learning something, you're learning how to make that cocktail, and, you know, and it's almost like trying to recreate what you were doing outside, and how, you know, recreating that in your own home. So there's been a lot of like stuff like that happening, which I think is quite interesting.
Do you also have like branding partnerships where, for example, I don't know, if it's a cognac or something, then you sort of partner up with a special kind of chocolate brand, or so, you know, some other, I don't know, if it's a whiskey, then you sort of, okay, I don't know if you can advertise cigars, but, you know, as in, has there been like some kind of a branding partnership, something which goes together for the experience?
It's something, it's done, yeah, traditionally it's done a lot. Like, for example, you'll see, for example, people like, who was it? Bullets Bourbon partnering up with Guinness. And, you know, then, for example, in Cocktail Week a while back, they were basically kind of serving Bullet with, you know, having like a beer and a chaser, but it was always like Guinness with a shot of Bullet. So there's loads of brands that will do that type of partnerships, or partner with chefs or things like that, or kind of artists to create bit like limited editions, or to create like a type of like food pairings, or, you know, very kind of unique experiences. That kind of is finding like-minded brands or brands that stand, or like bit like actual people and brands sometimes that kind of stand for a similar kind of side of things, or attract a similar type of consumer target audience, and kind of bring something that's quite tailored and unique to them. It's done very widely.
Okay, and how do you see it sort of developing then, this, because I mean, I also work freelance, so I appreciate some of the benefits that you perhaps also do, and at the same time, all of the jobs that we undertake do have this sort of time limited element to them.
Yeah.
So how do you see things sort of developing, as in, would you remain a freelancer? Will you jump across and, you know, take on a permanent thing maybe in the future, or with the same company that you're with now? How do you see things developing?
Well, I mean, my choice of going freelance at the time was always a temporary thing. Like, the reason why I did it was I'd been working in this more kind of experience kind of side of things for quite some time, and I wanted to go back into more kind of branding side of things, but and also from a career point of view, I had spent the best part of 12 years in just two companies, so very long stints. I wanted a bit of a challenge in a way, and kind of I felt like I had been like very, what's the word, complacent, and almost kind of, you know, just let things happen and been floating a bit as opposed to actually challenging myself. So A, obviously the freelance environment is challenging as it is because, you know, you need to be doing your own new business constantly. What's, you know, you're working now for 3 months, so you need to kind of figure out what's next pretty quickly. But also I was intrigued in being able to work with lots of different agencies, and both in terms of big agencies, small agencies, agencies that focus on different industries, or some that are more like your standard kind of brands, some that focus more on luxury, and having a bit more that breadth of understanding and knowledge of how different businesses work and define also what I like and I don't like moving forward. So I think I've been really lucky and been able to do that over the last 4 years. But the downfalls, if you like, of like freelance for me are, A, you can't really progress from a career seniority point of view, especially in my role, which is basically client management. You're never going to give the highest responsibility of a client to someone who's not part of your permanent staff. Mm. So there is a ceiling right there. And I've been doing my role now at, you know, at my level for the last maybe 6-7 years, and you know, you just can't go up as a freelancer. And also, you know, I like the longevity of things. I like kind of seeing the results of what I do, not just kind of starting the project and and then leaving halfway through or leaving just as it finishes. It's, you know, I like the idea of being able to develop that relationship with a client and bring in more business or kind of further that relationship, being able to kind of build up my team and, you know, be part of their development. There's that sense of you there for X amount of time and then you move into something else, which is fun for a bit, but, you know, it's getting a little bit tiresome. Mm. In a way. And also job insecurity, like, you know, like most freelancers with COVID, for example, that, you know, I was one of the freelancers that got hit quite badly with that in terms of, you know, where I was working at the time. They got rid of all freelancers end of April for obvious reasons, but until I only then started working in October. So I was out of work for 5 months, which is a long time.
Mm. Yeah, and absolutely.
It's something I don't want to be doing again.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real leveler, isn't it? This virus, as in, when you're sort of riding high, it's bam, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy. Yeah. All right. I had another question to ask you about that. Yeah. Okay. Okay. I know you a little bit. So obviously, you know, I live in Germany, and you know, Armin introduced us, and we don't, you know, have the opportunity to sort of, you know, go for a beer all the time. But you know, the little that I have seen of you, you've always been a very sort of, you know, okay, fun loving, of course, but reflective, a very mature person in the way that you communicate with others. And obviously very much respected by your friends. That's also particularly clear. So a lot of things which sort of, for me, define leadership. And from what you were discussing there, you know, there are levels where you want to reach. As in, so would you say your ambition thereafter would be to attain these sort of senior levels of management?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think it's something that it's not something that comes naturally to me in terms of, I've always said I'm a great second hand I'm a great right hand person rather than being the kind of the lead in a way. So I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't necessarily see myself starting a business and, you know, running that, but I would definitely be like, you know, the person you want to have on your side to make sure that things happen and lead a team kind of things. I think I've gotten to the point where I want that challenge and I enjoy that challenge and I enjoy kind of having people around me and working with people and helping guide, you know, people, younger generations, if you like, who are kind of coming up and be able to kind of provide that guidance. And you know I feel an immense pride in kind of seeing people that I work with succeed and kind of, you know, shine through what they do. So it's, again, it's part of the reason I was saying earlier in terms of going permanent. It's kind of gives you that, allows you to have that perspective and kind of, it's more the kind of building something in a way. And, you know, being part of that journey side of things and being able to take everything that I have learned over the last 15, 20 years and help shape something is something that, you know, I'm actually genuinely interested in. And that's what, you know, from a career point of view, that's where I'm headed, really.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, my fingers are crossed. It sounds to me like you're really enjoying the project that you're on at the moment. Obviously, long may that continue. And then, yeah, thereafter, I would love to hear that your next step is exactly in the direction that you have just outlined. So, yeah, good luck with that.
Thank you.
Yeah, I did also want to talk about another topic, but it would require a lot more analysis. So, but it's perhaps good to save something for another opportunity. Many things to save for another opportunity. But one little question based upon, you know, referring back to the, you know, the levels of objectivity that we were referring to and so on. You know, but my question is, in the next few years, is Barcelona or Manchester United going to be the more successful team?
Well, I'm not going to deny that I know nothing about English football. So on that one, I'm most 100% going to go with my heart and always Barcelona. 100%. Absolutely.
Fair enough. I expected no different. All right, but I mean, Messi, he's going to Manchester, right? As in the summer, he's city bound, isn't he?
You might do. You never know. Hey, you might end up in with good old Guardiola, and, you know, rekindle that little tandem of joy. Mm-hmm. So you might have trouble coming your way if that happens.
Yeah, but by then, as in, I mean, you know, a Messi who has, you know, much older legs. Okay, he's not going to run past too many of the United defenders, but we'll see. He's still a very good player.
I was going to say, I would like you guys to, you know, to see you guys stop him.
There were two finals between Manchester United and Barcelona in 3 years. And the challenge that Sir Alex had was to try to achieve just that. And he just wasn't quite able. So if he couldn't do it, I'm not sure there's a manager who can. But anyway, yeah, Messi's got older now. So,
yeah, it'll be interesting to see Barcelona without Messi. Mm-hmm. I think that's, you know, on that, that's going to be quite a, because I mean, so many people keep saying Barcelona without Messi is nothing, which I always kind of took huge offense to. Especially when, you know, Iniesta, Xavi, etc. were in. But, you know, right now it would be interesting to see, like, some of our more kind of junior players, like Ansu Fati, for example, who is doing amazingly, and, you know, who takes on that mantle, and, you know, are they actually able to rebuild the team from the ground up, really. So interesting times to come on that front.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, I mean, I wish you success, of course, except for when you're playing Manchester United. But, I mean, that's obviously quite natural. All right. Yeah. Annie, brilliant. Thank you very much. It's been very entertaining, but that doesn't come as a surprise at all. And yeah, I hope that you've enjoyed it too. Was it all right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, in fairness, I always love chatting to you. And, you know, obviously we don't get to do it often enough. So this was really nice.
Cool. Brilliant. All right. So then there shouldn't be an issue having you back for another chat at some point in the future.
Whenever you want. Just
fantastic.
Hit me up.
Brilliant. All right. Then I should allow you to enjoy the rest of your very, very social weekend. good luck with everything. And speak to you soon.
You too. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.